Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Bramau Ramos, and I am one of the hosts. And I am here today with Brian Miller to talk about his new book, Xiongnu, The World's First Nomadic Empire. Welcome to New Books, Brian, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
Well, great. That's a great place to start. So at the beginning, we do like to, you know, ask about your beginning. How did you come to work on archaeology and Central Asia, you know, broadly, but the Xiongnu specifically?
So when I first began my sort of graduate archaeology journey at UCLA, I was studying the first Chinese empires, the Qin and Han. And my interest was in nascent empires. How does an empire come to be when there is no history of an empire before it? There's no concept of, yes, let's do an empire again. And so most of my initial forays was into that. You know, I got involved in studying all the different policies and economics and industry of the Han Empire. And if one studies that, then you have to study this other beast that was fighting against trading with everything, the Han Empire. And the more I got into the Han Empire, the more I realized you can't understand it without understanding this other thing way up north called the Xiongnu. And as it happened to be, there was a professor there at the time working in the Negev, talked about nomad archaeology, and just one thing led to another. And I thought, rather than looking at the Qin and the Han, what if I looked at this other empire that's even more outside the realm of what we expect? That is, it seemed like the perfect case study to take in the hand and think, how can I poke holes in everything we think we know about empires and how they work? So that's sort of what launched me into it.
Oh, fabulous. So the unexpected, but empire. I'm fascinated how that, you know, that has continued through your interest in how do you create an empire when no empire had been before. So you talked about your PhD work there, your dissertation, and you mentioned in the acknowledgments of this book that this book did start out as your PhD dissertation. So what was the process of taking, you know, that, the dissertation and turning it into a book? What was that like for you?
It was definitely a much longer process. When one writes a dissertation, you have all these great ideas and you sort of put them out on the table, and then somebody sits you down and says, that's five books, choose one. But what I found was so I was very, very fortunate. I had both historians and archaeologists involved in my graduate studies. And what I found was both the history and the archaeology needed to be taken from square one. There was a lot of, you know, forays into the texts and what they've said, but without piecing together every single text that's available. And some of them have been translated, some of them have not been translated into English. And the same went for the corpus of archaeological data, which every year is growing bigger and bigger exponentially. You had these sort of realms of, you know, what's studied in Mongolia, the Mongolian archaeology sphere, you know, study stuff. And they sort of mention what's happening up there and what is now Russia, and mention a few sites down in North China. And the reverse happened as well. Talking to a lot of my Chinese colleagues, there are a handful of them that really like delve deep into this stuff, but it sort of got split. And so you'd see a map of Xiongnu sites in China, a map of Xiongnu sites in Mongolia, or a map of Xiongnu sites that has, like, you know, four or five of the key ones without taking into account all of them. So most of the process of the dissertation was going through every single site report in all of Russian, Chinese, and Mongolian, putting them to a massive database all the way down from what's the site like versus some other site. What is this burial like? What is that single grave good in that single grave like? It took a long time. And so that's mostly what the dissertation was, and it sparked some ideas. It's this idea of when you look at a set of data and you think, yeah, there's that data point that's an outlier, the more you engage with the entire corpus of data, you realize there's this collection of outliers that are no longer outliers. They are creating a pattern. And that's kind of what I saw in both the texts and the archaeological data. And so after digesting that for a while, you sort of produce the dissertation, you stand back and you look at it. All these ideas came more and more and more and more. So that's sort of what I steeped over for the next almost decade. And also, like, you know, as time goes on, different theories come and go. There's, you know, a such and such turn and a such and such turn in academia. And you sort of engage with it. So all these things were coming at me. You know, globalization was, you know, becoming a big thing in archaeology. Networks theory, network study were becoming a big thing. And all of this sort of affected the way I was looking at the case that I had with the Xiongnu. And so it's that whole process of digesting and rethinking and sort of looking at the data again and again that was the long durée process of creating the final book.
Mm-hmm. So both connections in terms of, you know, connecting different sites, but also then sort of networks and connections in the Xiongnu itself. I mean, that's it. That reminds me quite a bit of the middle part of your book. So is that sort of where that piece came from, sort of drawing?
Yeah, and giving a real structured approach to it. I think giving a very structured approach to the whole entity led to me also showing that it was a very structured entity, that there was a logic to it. It was a being. It was an organism that lived and breathed and adapted. It wasn't just some loose confederacy of, like, you know, barbarians that got together one day, conquered a bunch of stuff, and then the next day disappeared.
And we'll get into all, you know, you sort of outlined the coming together and then the disappearing, but not really. We'll get into both of those things as we go. But thank you for outlining that. I wanted right at the beginning to ask you about writing, because one of my favorite parts of reading your book was actually just reading it. It's a really great read. the prose is delightful. It's really clear. And I guess which isn't the case with all books. It's really funny in some places. And, you know, you really bring the reader into the grave sites, into the blood oaths, into all the fascinating moments that you touch on. So do you have a particular process as a writer, or is writing something that you think about? I guess I'm sort of wondering, you know, how did you write a book that read so well as this one does?
Thank you for saying that. You know, every writer sits down and goes, oh God, I can't understand what I'm saying at all. I think I'll start with the funny part, because there is funny stuff in there. There is really fun stuff. There is great, you know, for lack of a better word, great adventures. I think about all the Hollywood films that come out about historical fiction, and they totally butcher the events that actually happened. You think, if you just stick with what actually happened, it's really quite amazing. And so what I tried to do whenever possible is present the stuff that's really there to the reader, like the letter that Mo Dongchanyu writes to, you know, the wife of the deceased first Han emperor, and the response that comes is just, it's pure gold, literature gold, and it's right there. And so I wanted to take all this stuff out and present it as much as I could. That said, I think, you know, there are definitely little pop culture references, and I feel like it helps ground people, because the audience, to be quite honest, for this book, I had to do the proper things to make sure that, you know, my history colleagues accepted it and said, okay, he's done his due diligence. That my anthropological archaeology colleagues look at it and say, okay, he's done the right thing. He isn't going off the deep end something. But at the same time, the audience was really, you know, if you had to put it down, sort of like college student. If any sort of college student in a one-on-one class can pick it up and read it, if any, you know, random uncle of mine could pick it up and read it and enjoy it, then that's really the goal. Because I feel like there is an issue that we have to talk about of linking the so-called general public reading audience with this, like, hyper-academia stuff. And if we can't make known what we do, or make enjoyable what it is we do. We're very passionate about it, which is why we got involved in the first place. But to take that passion and the enjoyment and the funny parts that we see and impart that to the reader of any kind, then hopefully we've done our job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're the difficulty with the podcast is you're missing the sort of the visual of me nodding very, very intently. Okay. But so yes, 1,000 times yes to everything you said. Absolutely. If we cannot do that, what are we doing? But so, I mean, I think, you know, from one, you know, at least one reader, not your uncle, but someone who's, you know, quite outside this as a topic, I had a fabulous time reading it. It was very enjoyable. But you're talking about what actually happened, which I think moves us really nicely into the prologue. So I want to dive a little bit deeper into your book. And if you will allow me, I'd like to read the very first part. So the what actually happened. So this is how you start the book. The Chanyu, magnificent ruler of the vast steppe realms and master of all those who draw the bow, ascended a high mountain with his entire entourage and all the trappings for a traditional steppe ritual of a binding blood oath. He had chosen the particular frontier peak beyond the confines of any Chinese garrisons to convene with Chinese ministers and consecrate a new peace treaty. The oath ritual boldly commenced with the sacrifice of a white horse to sanctify the ceremony. Then the Chanyu took a ritual knife, shaved off bits of gold into a cup of alcohol, and stirred them in with a ceremonial spoon. He presented the gilded brew to the Chinese ministers in an aged cup fashioned from a human skull. It was an heirloom of the Xiongnu rulers, handed down from a previous conquering Chanyu over a century and a half before, hewn from the head of an enemy king who had once wronged the founder of the Steppe Empire. So speaking of, you know, what actually happened, this was, you know, this opening really grabbed me as a reader. But why, you know, as a writer, why did you choose to start your book here? What were you trying to show your reader about the Xiongnu through this episode?
There's always that notion of a sort of vignette hook to a book. I read a really fantastic book called The Invention of Nature, about Alexander von Humboldt. And the author did exactly that. She just laid it out, roped you right in from the beginning. I have to say that, you know, every place you go, you sort of add, you know, it aids to the book. The acknowledgments is profusely long because of that, because of all the people that have helped. And there was a fantastic group of mostly historians at Oxford University that I was privileged to be part of. And we talked a lot about this, the sort of vignette hook. And the one other thing we talked a lot about there was this idea of flipping the script. I mean, we've all, you know, gone through, you know, the Odyssey or the Iliad in high school. And we have this understanding of starting in medias res, right in the beginning of the middle of it all. And that's part of it. But the reason I started there is because this is the most famous event that most historians, not the histories themselves, but the historians since that point, have put out front and center and said, this is the beginning of the end of the Xiongnu. And everything I could see archaeologically said the exact opposite. And so seeing the way that archaeological narrative showed that this is not at all what's happening made me go back to the texts and think, I don't think the texts are actually saying that. And so going back and taking this scene, which for some reason no one's ever bothered to translate into English and put it all out there, I thought, well, we need to do this. The details of this scene make you realize that this is not a scene in which the Xiongnu leader is subservient. Yes, okay, I'm giving everything to you, the Chinese. You read it and you see everything is according to steppe traditions. And those Chinese ministers, I imagine, were sitting on top of that cold mountain with the wind blowing, surrounded by all these people, seeing this skull cup in their hands and thinking, oh, this is not going the way we wanted it to. Our emperor is not going to be happy with this. And so it is that thing of like taking an event And we talked a lot about that, this in our Nomads group, taking an event and flipping it around and thinking, you think you know history, you think you know the past, but it is not only nothing like what you thought it was, but it's also far more complex and interesting and nuanced and even funny, as you said, than we ever thought. And so I thought that's the perfect point. The point at which the story of the Xiongnu is supposed to rapidly go into decline is actually the point of resurgence.
Mm-hmm. I think as you put, I think it's at the end of the prologue, you say something along the lines of, in this book, the nomads take the center, I think, or take the center stage. Take center stage. That would be it. I think that so beautifully sort of captures what you were talking about there about the flip script and, you know, things not being as you might expect, as I'm sure those Chinese ministers thought as they were sitting there. Where is the submission? This is not going. This is not going well. Was this always the starting point of the prologue? You talked about sort of the writing group, reading group. Were there other moments that were contenders for this opening scene?
I had most of everything written, and I knew where it was going. I knew this is the life history of an entity, the beginning, middle, the end, the rises and falls, the peaks and valleys. And when I sat back and looked at it all, I thought, okay, what's a really interesting story? What's the most intriguing set of stories that, you know, could bring the reader in and make the reader identify with an individual person? That's the best way to bring them in. You talk about, you know, an archaeological culture and this culture versus that culture, and it's very impersonal. You have a moment, we have actual people we know about, and we know something that they did. Those sorts of events are the interesting ones to bring it in. Once I lay it out on the table, the mere handful of events that we have really good detail on, and this one just popped out, and I thought, oh, this is really interesting, and nobody's ever talked about this event. And then I thought, oh, well, this is clearly the event to flip the script upon.
Fabulous. The reason that I asked if anything else was a contender is because, you know, I think almost every one of your chapters does open with a beautiful object or site or, you know, something really specific. And so chapter one opens with one of these. It opens with a sheep ankle bone, and you provide a wonderfully rich analysis of it. You discuss, you know, the surface of the ankle bone, how it's smooth, it's been handled repeatedly. You talk about, you know, such bones being found at other sites, indicating a large suite of cultural traditions. The bone has etchings on it, so there's, you know, a scheme of symbols at play here, and in turn, you know, some sort of centralized control. And this bone itself then is really, you know, representative of the way that you're using material evidence throughout your book. So could you talk a little bit about this? How does, you know, using and, you know, combining material evidence with written records, help show, you know, help you allow the nomads to take center stage?
It's really a lot about you use as many data sets as you can in whatever analysis you're doing, be it history or biology. And that was the biggest struggle in this book. There have been, you know, I'm not the first to write about the Xiongnu. There have been historians who, you know, bring in a little bit of archaeology. There have been archaeologists who bring in a little bit of history. But, you know, because of the push that I got from some of my advisors in graduate school, it's time to take the whole corpus of both and weave them together, which is not an easy process because you have this idea of like, do they conflict with each other? Do they come together a perfect puzzle, or do they contradict each other? And in that contradiction, in your search for some sort of way of having a narrative that does fit both sets of data, you come with a whole new context of understanding, a new narrative. Part of it also was, again, trying to think of the audience being somebody who is not an archaeologist, and perhaps also not a historian, to be able to pick it up and to understand the process that historians go through in searching through the text and pulling them out and analyzing the little bits of passages that are in there. So I tried to, some chapters emphasize more the history, some chapters emphasize more the archaeology, but I tried to show the reader, this is the process of textual analysis. And the same goes for archaeology. This is the process in which, you know, we look at whole sets of data. This is the process in which we can pick up one tiny little object that seems very unassuming and suddenly realize that's the pinnacle of everything. You asked about the opening prologue. I thought long and hard about it. This one, however, was very personal, and it has always been at the forefront of my mind. Every time I think about the Xiongnu, the fact that, you know, the first time I ever went on excavations for Xiongnu stuff, it was right there in the ground and popped out, and somebody said, Brian, what's this like writing on this piece of bone? What? What is this? I don't know. Like, let's think about it. And it's just sparked everything ever since then. And no matter what I do, I always ended up coming back to this thing. So yeah, it's a way to hook the reader, but it's also a way to show the reader, this is the kind of things that you can get just from one little object.
You do such a great job with it of sort of moving, you know, from as you were describing there, from the material to like the big, the big, right? So you move really smoothly, but also very, you know, I'm glad you mentioned, you know, sort of teaching, because this to me was a great example of, you know, this is how we do close reading. We start with observations and then we move outwards. You too can do it, reader. sort of, I guess, running in the background. When you first saw this particular ankle bone, where did it fall in your sort of field work? Was it sort of near the beginning or the middle or the end, or what was this, the first ankle bone you've seen? Oh, really?
By some bizarre chance, I switched and knew I wanted to study the Xiongnu. I joined someone else's project. They were doing prehistoric Bronze Age stuff down in this valley. I just got to go get my feet wet in Mongolia. Even though the whole time, I talked to the project director. It's like, I really want to do Xiongnu, but I'll help out. I did survey, excavation, as one does in archaeology. And then the Mongolian collaborator was working at a Xiongnu royal cemetery the valley over. And when he was asking, for a ride on, I think he rode a motorcycle from one valley over to the next. And the guy who gave him a ride saw the place that the Mongolian archaeologist was working at and said, oh yeah, we have one of those sites in our valley. The Mongolian archaeologist, who knew everything about every Xiongnu site everywhere, said, no, you don't. And the debate ensued, and he said, fine, why don't you take those people over? Lo and behold, up in the hills, tucked into the forest of the valley we had been working at for weeks, was this massive royal cemetery of the Xiongnu, which we thought, well, we can't not map this. We can't not document this. This is an amazing discovery. So we mapped it, and some tiny little article came out that year. It ended up being the largest Xiongnu cemetery in the world, with the largest Xiongnu tomb in the world. And by some chance, the following summer, I was allowed to go up and start excavating all the little satellite graves next to that huge tomb. And the first grave that actually had, these were all looted. But the first grave that actually had stuff like really coming out that we could, log and bag and everything, was the grave of this child. And in this pile of, polished and used ankle bones were a bunch of them that had markings on them. So literally from the very first time I ever was lucky enough to have a summer to go excavate and be part of, unearthing the past of the Xiongnu, I stumbled across this ankle bone. And so for that reason, it really has been in my mind ever since.
Wow. And so I guess the moral of that story is follow the guy on the motorcycle.
Guy on the motorcycle. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked about the ankle bone now. Thank you for that. If I can move us a little bit deeper into the book. So you mentioned, unearthing history. And I guess this then takes us to chapters 2 and 3, where you do some more unearthing. So these chapters, take the reader into the founding and consolidation of the Xiongnu Empire. So you first, you set the scene, you show what Inner Asia, Central Asia looked like before the Xiongnu launched their conquest. And you make the point that this area was as you say, as diverse in antiquity as it is today. So there's, you know, a real patchwork of pastoral societies, you know, in the area. So, you know, there are lineages that existed. So when the Xiongnu come to power, they did so by harnessing these different networks. And in chapter three, then, you emphasize that the course of the Xiongnu conquests was more about inclusion, not destruction. So I'm curious about how you, you know, you thought of that play between, you know, thinking about what is inclusion, what is destruction, what is going on here. What would you say was sort of the, you know, the key, if you like, to the Xiongnu being able to form this sort of inclusive, centralized system?
I think part of it is we have this notion of these nomad entities are enigmatic. They sort of jump out of nowhere, and all of a sudden they're on the stage that we can't explain where they came from. But we actually can. Again, I know I'm somewhat biased, but you know, archaeology to the rescue. There are many, many Mongolian archaeologists and foreign collaborators that have been working in Mongolia for quite some time, doing exactly the prehistory periods that I mentioned before. And they have shown time and again that there's unbelievable amount of, you know, political complexity and interregional networks and trade and all these things are going on. So the seeds were there. The network was already there. It just wasn't in control by one lineage yet. And so by the time you get to the Xiongnu emergence, this one lineage who then gives itself a dynasty name of Xiongnu, that everything's already there. And part of the reason too, I wanted to give the detailed description of Inner Asia beforehand is because there's this concept that, you know, the people in Inner Asia didn't have anything going for them before then, which they did. And also that if they wanted to have any sort of model of political complexity of state building, well, they had to look down to China, which was the only possible model. And we know that that's certainly not true either. It was one of many models for sure. But the fact that there was this huge state, or very complex, you know, sort of tucked in there in the Altai Mountains, that archaeologists refer to as Pezetic, it was there, and it was definitely the model, the art, the social hierarchies, the long distance trade, everything it was doing was certainly a clear model to the rising Xiongnu powers. And so when we see them start to emerge, you can see how they took on the networks that are already there in the Mongolian steppes. They looked to, you know, China, to this Pazurik, to everything around them, and said, we're going to put together something that is all of this that we know.
So you show how they put everything together. By chapter four, the Xiongnu is there. And then you start to look at the different institutions that the Xiongnu developed to reign, you know, both light and heavy over a broad expanse of people and territory. And so there's a lot in this part of the book about empire and local communities and a lot about belts. And it's the belts I would love to ask you about, because there's a lot of them. Why were belts so important to the Xiongnu as sort of like a basic question, but sort of more digging a little bit deeper? Why are, you know, how are they important to you and your book, if you like? You know, how are you using them in your work?
I am assuming there are many materials that were very important to the Xiongnu at the time. Part of the reason I look to belts, because archaeologists and art historians time and again keep coming back to them, because we're lucky enough that they're made out of bronze, so they preserve. All the millions of textiles that probably had very intricate designs that, because of preservation, they just dissipate and we don't find them anymore. So belts are probably only one of many different sort of sets of material culture, you know, accoutrements of political participation was out there. And so you just sort of latch on as an archaeologist. Okay, what's the data I can look at? Let's look at it. And it's a big enough data set as well that you can look at that. And so for me, the sort of transition from chapter three into chapter four is all about, okay, you've gone out, conquered all these realms. They are diverse. You've set up everything to, you know, bring in tons of surplus, because surplus is the necessity of the big state, and diversity as well. to ensure like a stable economy, a stable political economy. And chapter four is all about how do you maintain that? When I was interested in these, you know, nascent empires, how do they rise and how do they keep going? It's that second question of how do they keep going that really drives chapter four. And so they must have had something. You know, by the end of the book, I mentioned Attila the Hun. I mentioned, you know, Tan Shi Huai, this other Xianbei leader. And they never really went much of anywhere. They did a lot of damage when they were alive. But as soon as they're dead, the whole thing just crashing down. So what was it about the Xiongnu that wasn't, you know, the same kind of story yet again? How do they keep going for hundreds of years? And so it's looking into the concepts of, you know, if you have a stable state, especially imperial state that keeps going, it must have cities, roads, bureaucracy, writing, all those things. And so one by one, I have to go through all the things of all the different institutions and the materials related to those institutions and say, they had stuff. It's just not what we usually are thinking of or assuming you must have. And so by that argument, you know, how do you keep this whole thing together? There's this, you know, notion of the political community. And if you have that, then how are you demonstrating that you're part of that? And I think belts are one way to get at that. In the early Xiongnu, it's a very interesting pattern of everybody has, you know, more or less the same kind of belt. You see the exact same motif just mass reproduced all across in different workshops. And yet their burial traditions are very different. And so you start to wonder about, like, are these the remnants of the objects for the expression of political participation, you know, both up and down?
Hmm. When you're talking about, you know, having different stuff, you know, thinking about different models, something you come to a few times in this chapter is about how the Xiongnu strategy was controlling not land and production, but movements and products. Would that sort of fall under, you know, they had stuff, it's just different stuff. Is that a different example of having different stuff then?
It's a little bit of, again, all these, you know, theories that archaeologists were playing around with while I was writing the book, one of which was social networks analysis and networks theory. And, you know, some people delved into very detailed, you know, database social networks analysis. Some people just engaged with general networks thinking, it was called. But that was it. If you think of, you try and sort of map out a political entity in the prehistoric, you know, pre-nation state era, it's actually more productive not to map it out as a blob. You know, you draw the lines and you do the big circle and there's the empire, but as a set of dots. You get to see where the densest part of the dots is. You get to see the expanse of the dots. You get to see where there's this weird far-flung dot way, way out that somehow is connected to the rest of the entity, even though it seems to be out there all alone. And that's a more productive way to think about empires and understand them, but also that's more closely to how they actually worked. This idea that, you know, inside the bubble, every square inch of land was directly managed and thought of and controlled, just wasn't true. And so I think when you look at something like a so-called nomad empire, which is where, you know, I stumbled across these, you know, things in the text, and one of which was this thing called Xinguo. And the Chinese were using it to talk about those people out there. They have a kind of state, a guo, that is mobile. It's moving. But then when you look down deep into what those are, it was really more about, like, not so much the state was mobile, maybe it was, but it was the state in which the people were mobile, because it describes them as they don't stick to the earth. And then you sort of come back out of the Han era texts and think about all the kinds of things that, you know, we as anthropological archaeologists think about, you know, states and what they do and how they function. And it really is the control of surplus, the production of surplus, the ensuring that that surplus can be produced or obtained, and the maintaining of the control of that surplus and moving it around. Why in the world would a local community choose to participate beyond the idea of the threat of the army could come in and just smash you? Why would they continue to participate in this if it wasn't for the fact that they're now tied into this whole network of supply chains. If something goes wrong, they can tap into that network of huge surpluses that's just going all around and get access to it. And so then they start to say, okay, the local leaders are, okay, we're going to be part of this network, but we are in control. So everybody else in the valley has to come to us because we're the only way that they can get access to this bigger political network. Enter the belts. These are the badges of prestige. They're showing we are part of the network of this much, much bigger network. So if you want to be able to move outside of your normal winter movements, you got to come to us to talk because we manage the movements in this valley. But we also give access to, you know, this huge surplus.
It all comes back to the belts. you were describing there, you know, very and extremely compelling, you know, reasons as to why you would want to be part of this and what it, you know, what you benefit from it. And you talk about in this chapter about how this is a very flexible, you know, empire, you know, in general, pretty resilient, pretty prosperous. But this chapter ends sort of on an ominous note that the flexibility, you know, left the empire open to challenges, which you look at in the next two chapters of your book. So chapter 5 focuses on the war that the Xiongnu had with the Han Empire, but you make the point that the Han invasions were not what caused, you know, any kind of defeat or, you know, wound to the Xiongnu Empire. Instead, it was sort of within, if you like. So this is something that you get into a little bit further into at the end of chapter 5. But, you know, there's lots of different names and different factions at play and at war, but the Xiongnu survive. And then in chapter 6, we sort of see the revived Xiongnu regime, one that has a much more cosmopolitan, you know, political culture. So there's a lot going on in these chapters. There's a lot of challenge and disorder and, you know, falling apart a little bit, but not really, and then really falling apart, but then coming back. So within all of this, is there something that you really want to emphasize about this period of the history of the Xiongnu Empire?
I think it's that entities like this that last a long time are intriguing to look at in detail. And how in the world did that happen? A lot of it is, you know, the right place, right time kind of thing. But it is looking at, you know, this political entity under the microscope, and which is why I sort of do this nested approach from the community up to the whole thing to see how it would have operated. And I think there's this idea of like the nation state, and it's there, it's the bubble. But we have to burst the bubble. If we take this sort of like nodes and networks kind of idea, like, you know, what would happen if you sort of lopped off one of the nodes? Would it keep going? This concept, I think, I know I mentioned earlier Alexander von Humboldt, but I keep coming back to him as well. This idea of, you know, nature is not a perfect order. That is, everything is very violent. It's very vibrant. It can move and shift. Things can change all the time. And so he called it very organic. And I think that's the way we should look at a state like this, especially this so-called nomad empire. It's not a machine. It's an organism. And to see it adapting, you know, to healing its wounds, to all these things, is a very interesting process to watch. So if anything, it wasn't that the Han-Xiongnu conflict brought the empire down. It may have fanned the flames of things that were already brewing inside. I previously mentioned, why would you participate in this political entity? The question arises, why would you let someone else run that political entity? Why not rise up with enough power, because you got the surplus? Now you say, I'm the one in charge of this whole beast. And that's what really brings the empire down for this period of civil war.
Mm. You know, as we're talking about, you know, communities, networks, you make the point, I think it's in chapter 6, that any search, you're talking about imperial authority. You make the point that this polity is spatially dispersed and disjointed, yet socially cohesive. And you sort of lay out why this is important to sort of recognize. Is there something about this, that sort of, I guess, dichotomy that so interested you? Why is this sort of the big emphasis point of this chapter?
I think because we assume without roads, you can't have any communication. But, you know, as we know, you had not only community mobility through carts and tents and everything else, you have individual mobility through everybody's getting on the horse, men, women, children. And it increases, you know, temporary mobility of a few people, of whole armies, of everything else. And I think, you know, reflecting on, you know, if you have a book, you try and relate somehow to the reader who doesn't know anything about the past or, you know, isn't, you know, accustomed to reading or understanding, like, how in the world did things in the ancient past work? You come to these things of, we're now in the digital age and you don't have to go into work. You can have a whole company, whole meetings over Zoom, and yet they're spatially dispersed, yet socially they're very tightly bound. Hmm. And I think that concept, if you move backwards, you realize, okay, they had better communications. You know, they had these badges of prestige. So when you went all the way over to, say, you know, the Altai Mountains, and you found this community, they're wearing the exact same thing. You knew immediately they're part of the network. They're signaling somehow that stuff is happening. I think that's the real key to think about how you have social cohesion despite this spatial dispersion.
When you were describing, you know, the Zoom, that reminded me so vividly of when you were describing, you know, the process of writing, about the importance of relating things back to the present day and to things that we, you know, so know so intimately, right? That we can all be very dispersed yet connected through Zoom. So thank you for making that connection. You mentioned when we were talking about belts that, you know, certain things don't survive. So textiles don't survive. But you have a few in this chapter, or at least you have one, I seem to remember. You talk about, I really desperately want to say it's a carpet, but I might be misremembering.
Are not incorrect. this is a case of rare preservation. There's a couple of the sites of these royal tombs that they're deep enough that they have, and they're in the right place in the landscape, that there was permafrost that occurred, in which case you get all these organics. The collection of sites that I worked on way out in Western Mongolia with my colleague Bayer Sachen a long time ago, we were also very fortunate there to get preservation of a lot of organics. And so because of that, of those moments, then you can draw those out and say, oh my goodness, look at what else we have. So it's not just the fact that you have all these, you know, gold or turquoise inlaid items, you know, all these turquoise inlaid gold buttons that are matching exactly to the T, the kind of gold turquoise inlaid buttons that elites would have had in Central Asia, you know, in the what eventually became the Kushan regime. It's not a mistake.
The reason I was thinking of the fabrics, the textiles, the reason they stood out to me here was because when you use them in this chapter, you're using them to speak specifically to the kind of culture that you have in this sort of late Xiongnu Empire. Is there something in particular that you want to really highlight about that here? This seems like a slightly different, and maybe it's just different in terms of the sources that you have, but how would you characterize sort of, you know, the what you could know about the culture of this period?
Yes, there was a definite moment when you sort of, like I said, look at all the data at once, that different patterns, like when you stared at those old paintings and suddenly you see a sailboat, you get these things. And, you know, a couple of colleagues of mine and I sat down, realized, oh my goodness, there's an early Xiongnu and a late Xiongnu culture. I talk profusely about belts, but you get to the late Xiongnu and these open work belts with all these very specific scenes of two yaks, two horses, two panthers grappling with a snake serpent thing. They're all gone. What happened? Like, it's really quite astounding. And suddenly bronze is out. Iron covered with gold or silver is in. And so there's a radical shift in this late period. And I don't think it's any mistake that that kind of stuff starts to be a totally new set of, you know, new fashions and political culture that come after the Civil War. So the Xiongnu regime rises up again, sort of has to reinvent itself And only after that point do you suddenly see these big square tombs for the royals. Do you see all this crazy stuff from all over the world? They had connections. They had foreign stuff that was coming in. But it goes to an exponential level in the late period so that you have all these objects. And so one of the things that we were also looking at, you know, that I think globalization theories really helped us with is there's been a long-standing notion ever since they started unearthing these big royal graves that because they found all this Chinese stuff in there, they thought, oh, they're becoming Chinese. And that was part of the traditional narrative of historians saying the more Chinese stuff you have, well, of course you become Chinese. You can't not have a Chinese thing and not suddenly just, you know, spill over and just have your culture be completely Sinified. And it just wasn't sitting well with us. And so we started to stoop over and we looked at the whole assemblage. Well, what's all the stuff they have? It's not all Chinese, is it? No, it's not. And more importantly, what do they do with that Chinese thing or that Chinese stuff when they get it? They're not using it in the same way. You get a Chinese chariot, but you take it apart. You would never take it apart on China, but you disassemble that thing quickly in a Shongnu royal grave. You get some Chinese silk. It's beautiful. It's got these rhombus patterns. What do? You cut it up and you have it so it trims your nice felt step rug. So that whole body of globalization literature, globalization, all these other theories coming around, like you can have this sort of cosmopolitanness that's going on. You're bringing in everything from the outside, but you're not converting to it. You're trying to exude yourself as being this worldly, continental scale set of elites. We also looked into, you know, okay, what about other models of when people are consuming everything Chinese? You know, we jump forward in time many, many centuries to, you know, the so-called age of exploration in Europe. Chinoiserie is the big thing. It's so big that eventually the Dutch say, okay, we're going to make our own version of it with Delft. But you would never have said that the Europeans were becoming Chinese. They were becoming very global and worldly. And it wasn't just the uber elites in Europe that had it. All the way down, suddenly it trickles down where everybody's got some of this China. And that's why we call these things, you know, these high porcelains China. And so the same kind of thing was happening in the Xiongnu communities. It wasn't just the big royal tombs. When we went out west and we found, you know, every single grave, whether it's a baby or, you know, old man, had fragments of Chinese silk in there. Well, what in the world is Chinese silk doing consumed by everybody, but worn as like undergarments underneath a normal like felt overcoat? They're not becoming Chinese at all. They're consuming all these global scale products and bringing them in to the point where even one woman has, you know, pieces of a broken Chinese mirror, and her necklace has this weird like Egyptian style imitation faience bead around her necklace. How in the world is she getting that thing? It's some small little community way over the mountains that's supposedly coming from or influenced by objects coming all the way over from the so-called Mediterranean world. It's a very new era, I think, in the late Xiongnu period.
It's a fascinating chapter, and it's, you know, the materials that you have, like I mentioned, the carpet, but the the beads and everything, it is very, very rich. And I feel bad then asking about the end, because as you described it, this wonderful, you know, I say wonderful in the rich sense, the cosmopolitan, the trade, the silk underlay, everything does come to an end. The empire does disintegrate in fits and starts, as you look at in your book. But though the empire comes apart, you touch on how the legacy did continue. So could you talk a little bit about this legacy? How and where do we sort of see it going forward, even, you know, long after the Xiongnu are gone and the Chanyu are gone?
It is a really interesting legacy. The first legacy that anyone ever asks about is, are the Xiongnu the Huns? And I do have to defer to, you know, several of my colleagues who have much more directly engaged with this, and I put them in citations. But one of the interesting works that I really love is by Christopher Atwood, who, by the way, has a new translation of The Secret History of the Mongols. It's brilliant. He made two points, is that Xiongnu is actually the name of a dynasty, not the name of a people. We know the name of the lineage in control, the Luandi lineage, Xuliandi, whatever you want to call it. We know all these names. And that dynasty name has such extreme power because it is the name of an entity that lasted so long and had so much influence, that what he did is he traced the way the name moved. Not talking about people moving. There's this whole thing of like, oh, look at the cauldrons move. Well, the cauldrons were already over there in the western part of Eurasia before the Xiongnu even existed. As you watch the name move, and that's something else entirely. And so one can very well imagine that, all the way over, maybe there's some fledgling families or somebody moves this way and that way, and you end up with the name Hongai or Hun way over there at the edge of the Roman realms. But when I thought, okay, well, how can we look back on it inside Eastern Asia and see the way it goes? And you see the same exact thing happening, this use and abuse and heralding of the name Xiongnu itself and the title of Chanyu. And in the couple centuries afterwards, in the so-called, Northern Dynasty's conquest period of Chinese history, you see that name coming up again and again. You see certain leaders saying, oh, I have Xiongnu heritage, but I also have Han Dynasty heritage. I have this and I have that. They're just throwing it around. Whether they actually lay claim, whether they really have some sort of family connection or not, is beside the point. It's a name that has such power that it is wielded. And the other thing, even as that slowly trickles away, people just stop using the title of Chanyu. They stop saying, oh, I have Xiongnu heritage, because it doesn't matter anymore. But even after that, the model of the Xiongnu, how to deal with a foreign entity, a great foreign power in the histories of Chinese dynasties ever since the Han, they always come back to the example of the Xiongnu. There's a bunch of people fleeing down from the border. What do we do with them? Well, in the time of the Xiongnu and the Han, they did this. Or, even during the Tang Dynasty, when they're dealing with the Turks, all these famous poets like Li Bo, who are writing, they take out the word Turk and they put in the word Xiongnu, because it has that staying power, that sort of legendary notion. You have even, to the point of, all the invasions of the Roman Empire with the Huns in World War I, you have these posters of German soldiers coming to get you in, Western Europe, France or wherever else. And it says, beat back the Hun. That name has such power. It just goes everywhere and everyone knows it. So, that's definitely one of the legacies. But that's outside of Inner Asia, especially as you get to the Mediterranean world in Europe. It's a legacy of death and destruction. But within Inner Asia, I think it's a very different legacy. It's a legacy of power and success and capability, to the point that this decimal system of organizing yourself, all these other things, the titles, the way you move, the way you sort of reach out from a home base right in the center of what is now Mongolia, is a pattern that the Turks picked up, the Uyghur, and even the Mongols themselves. And so when I sort of end the book, I say, well, everybody knows about the Mongols, or you think you know them. They enigmatically came out of nowhere. No, they didn't. They were very good students of history. They knew their past. They knew this deep past of the Turks and the Xiongnu and everything else. And so that, to me, is the legacy. Again, it gets back to this idea of when does an empire come about where there's no precedent for it? Well, once that precedent is set with the Xiongnu, it's the model people keep coming back to.
Mm-hmm. We are coming, as you sort of hinted at, we're coming at the very, to the very end of the book here. But I did want to touch on the epilogue before we sort of move away entirely. because, thinking of lessons and lessons from history, you sort of address that directly in the epilogue, in thinking about nomadic regimes and empires more broadly. So, you talk about how we should approach empires like the Xiongnu as, you know, not being enigmas, talk about how we should, you know, do better, I guess I'll put it that way, in sort of approaching the history of nomadic regimes more broadly. But is there something in particular that you want to really highlight or really hit home here, I guess, when it comes to, you know, the, you know, bigger lessons, bigger ways of thinking about nomadic regimes in general?
I think the case of the Xiongnu and nomadic regimes in general should sort of make us rethink everything else we think we know. I mean, there's definitely ways in which I have totally rethought about the Qin and the Han after studying the Xiongnu. It makes me rethink, like, wow, why would you ever think of an empire in that way or this way? Like, that's not how it's functioning. If the Xiongnu can do it that way, then maybe it wasn't exactly the way we thought it was in these, you know, classic empires. It makes us rethink everything else too. I mean, I definitely had conversations with people in other universities, other institutes, where I'm trying to explain my model of empires of mobilities. You know, and some people look at me and say, oh, so like the Dutch East India Company. Well, exactly. This tiny little core that seems very like an unassuming little tiny nation state. And yet somehow it has commanded these vast networks of power and just dominating the whole world from this tiny little country, so-called tiny little country. All of them, it makes you rethink the ways that, you know, it doesn't just have to be a singular bubble nation state concept of the ancient empire. It makes me rethink everything within Central Asia. I mean, you have later on, you have the Sogdians. You know, what about the ways in which regimes can go? What about, you know, massive global companies that are defying nation states because the nation states are trying to make global companies behave like other nation states, and the global companies are saying, no, we're not going to do that. It's just a really interesting case of, you know, looking at an entity like the Xiongnu and thinking, how do they defy everything we think we know about states in the way that political entities should operate and function and move?
It is a fascinating, you know, case study. It's beautifully told here, both in your sort of explanation, but in the book more broadly. But as we've come to the sort of the end of the book, and also we're nearing the end of our conversation, now that this book is done, what are you working on now? What is inspiring you at the moment? Is it the Dutch East India Company, or is it something a little closer to the Xiongnu?
I mean, definitely, you know, I'm sure there'll be a few spin-off papers about the Dutch East India Company, or, you know, there are always entertaining references to pop culture, whether it's, you know, the Death Star or, you know, Captain Nemo or anything else. But I think the next bigger project is to look back at these belts that you mentioned. And to, you know, when you think about what are the big theories and the big models that are sort of swimming within Eurasia, Inner Asia, the steppe, besides this issue of like the nomad regime, how does it function, how does it move, what's the history of it? There's a whole other set of literature that came out from some ideas that popped up in the very beginning of the 1900s called, when people looked at the art of the steppe. You have people like Peter the Great and Catherine the Great who've been excavating these things left, right, and center, popping up. But there's a scholar, Rostovtsev, and others who came up with this idea of like, well, it's all about the animals. Where are the humans in this? Because, you know, this notion of art and high art was this very Greco-Roman thing of, well, it must have humans and they must be depicted in a certain fashion. Here you have all this high art in which you don't really see humans at all. And so there's been this concept of animal art that's been around for forever. But how do we approach it again without the similarities, I think, come from a lot of things in my book of what is a so-called nomad? How do we unpack that word nomad? How do we get rid of all the assumptions of mobile pastoral peoples and steppe societies and cultures? How do we undo that? Because I think there's something still simmering in the assumptions about steppe art and the so-called animal style that, you know, it's just nomadic art. And, you know, see, it's an evidence of those wandering nomads yet again. There's something more. So I think I want to return to that.
As someone who, you know, closed this book and was just had to immediately go and find more images of belts and read more about the belts, that sounds like a fabulous project. And I'm very much looking forward to it. So best of luck with that, Brian. And, you know, thank you again so much for taking the time to talk with me about this book, this project, and these belts.
Thank you so much, Sarah.